So
I think actually I fear this is going to count against you in the voting for.
I'm almost certain it will.
I think you're going to be voted off Feminist Frequency Island.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of Feminist Frequency Radio. I'm your host, Carolyn Pettit. Yes, as Anita is enduring an agonizingly long flight back from Europe, we are going to have some fun here. So I'm filling in for Anita here on the Wheels of Steel, and I'm joined this week, as always, by Ebony Astor. Hey, Ebony.
What's up, Carolyn?
And this week, we are thrilled to have, for the first time, Feminist Frequency's mysterious fourth member, Ashley Fellows. Hey, Ashley.
Hey, y'all.
This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, were the feminist killjoys coming for your medias, depending on your perspective. On today's show, Ebony's going to take us through some of the latest entertainment news. We're going to talk about Pixar's exuberant new film, Coco. And in light of the recent Avengers Infinity War trailer, we're going to talk about some cultural ideas of masculinity and maybe how they kind of intersect with representations of superheroes like Captain America. Finally, we're each going to discuss something we've been thinking about lately in What's Your Deal, which Anita isn't here to complain about the name of.
That's right.
And just for our drip backers, we're going to be doing a bonus segment in which we respond to a pretty huge social media brouhaha that occurred this week when we here at Feminist Frequency dared to make it explicitly, unwaveringly clear that ours is a trans-inclusive feminism. Finally, Ebony will lighten the mood with another selection of hand-picked emails in Hate Mail Hoot Nanny. If you are backing us there on Drip, thank you so much. We really appreciate all your support and enthusiasm. This podcast is entirely listener-supported on Kickstarter's new monthly crowdfunding subscription service, Drip.
Mm-hmm.
If you like what you hear, please consider chipping in. Just visit d.rip/femfreak. All right, so Ashley, before we really get things started here, you know, why don't you take a moment to tell the folks at home a little bit about yourself?
Sure, yeah. Lover of feminism, obviously. And as
good,
you
good.
Both know.
I like what I'm hearing. I
say
like
no
it.
More. I
like
don't
it.
Need to elaborate.
Yeah.
And as you both know, lover of snacks. I love a good snack.
Where are you today, Ashley? Where are we talking to you from?
Yeah, so I'm located in Chicago, where it is a balmy 60 degrees, which is nothing but disconcerting.
Wow.
Isn't that so weird? It's December. I was, like, gearing up for a Chicago winter. I was, like, buying boots, a jacket.
Oh, it's coming. It's coming, Ashley.
Well, I'll check in with you then, and I'll start complaining about that. Have no fear. But, like, right now, it is 60 degrees, and it is just weird. Chicago.
Yep. Chicago, great. And what do you do for us here at Feminist Frequency? I'm ostensibly asking for the audience, but really I'm asking for myself. I have no clue what you do for us here at Feminist
Come on.
Frequency.
It's been over a year.
I know.
Well, we have such a huge staff.
That
Anita pays with all of the millions and millions of dollars that she scammed from, you know, ignorant audience members. So, you know, it's easy to lose track of the thousands of people that she employs to do this, bullshit feminist work, right?
It's basically like I'm Mr. Burns and Ashley's Homer Simpson, and each week I have to be like,
it's a lot like that.
That's
a lot like
Homer,
that.
That's Homer Simpson,
I mean,
sir.
Like
I just never... Exactly.
Yeah, no,
So what do you do for us?
All of those millions that we're being paid with, you can thank me. I help out with the fundraising and communications, lots of development work. So basically, right now, like any sort of newsletter you're getting about end of year giving, et cetera, that is coming straight from me.
Nice.
Yeah. So, and also a big part of it, I think, is better helping get the word out about Feminist Frequency. So going out, having events, meeting people. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Well, we're super. Yeah, and we're thrilled to finally have you here on FFR. Ebony.
Yeah, it's great because, you know, people are getting a chance to hear from Ashley. And so I encourage people to vote one of us off the island of Feminist Frequency Radio. There can only be three. So, you know, after this episode and you get a taste of Ashley, decide who you want your three hosts to be.
Yeah.
And then just drop that into Twitter. And Yeah,
as long as we can get Jeff Probst to come in and be like, you know, the tribe has spoken, I'm in. I'm down.
As long as I get to do a really like teary, dramatic, sobbing confessional, I'm already in a closet. So you just need to set up a camera in here.
All right.
But yeah, I'm all for that. I didn't come here to make friends.
Oh yeah, and
much like
Survivor, I will do anything for peanut butter. Like there's always that challenge where they're like, "Will you do this?" And I'm just like, "Yes, yes, I will."
Speaking of incredibly dramatic situations of conflict, Ebony, why don't you take us through some of the week's big entertainment news stories? Well, what do you got for us?
I won't say that they're the week's big entertainment news stories, but it's the things I give a shit about. And really, isn't that what this podcast is built upon? Things that
Absolutely.
Ebony gives a shit about. So one, I wanted to let folks know about the live action Mulan. So people remember the Disney film Mulan, and there has been lots of concern, rightfully so, among, you know, Asian American communities that the casting for this movie might be problematic, because let's face it, you know, the history in Hollywood is that if you can find a white actor to play, you know, a person of color, that's the route that producers tend to go.
Yeah, but particularly with Asian roles, I think
exactly
white actors have been kind of, you know, yellow faced or kind of just shuffled into those roles. So
it's as if, you know, well, it exactly is that, you know, the assumption is that culture and race and ethnicity are essentially accessories that anybody can don, but especially white people can don, right? So there was, I think, you know, some justifiable concern that with this live action Mulan, that, you know, there was going to be a cast primarily of white actors padding the roles, and the Asian actors were going to get barely a look in, that it was going to be essentially a whitewash production. But lo and behold, an actual Chinese actress has been cast as Mulan. Mm-hmm. Her name is, and I'm not going to pronounce this correctly, Lu Yifei. I believe she also goes by Crystal Lu. This news reported last week, so something to be cautiously optimistic about. At least we aren't going to have Emma Stone, bless her heart, playing Mulan. So starting with that bit of good news, then I also wanted to talk about a show, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Either of you guys watch Crazy Ex-Girlfriend?
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
Francis stole Pee-wee's bike.
No.
Yeah, I watched the first season on Netflix. I haven't caught up with anything happening since then.
Okay, same. Same. I'm in that same place. It's a show that I find incredibly entertaining, incredibly smart. Like, I enjoy it every time I watch it. And yet, I am not a musical theater person. And so I always find myself having to adjust when songs break out, even though I was a hardcore fan of the show Fame when it came out in the 80s. Whatever. Uh-huh. That's a little piece of Ebony history we'll get into in a later podcast. But anyways, I found it really interesting that Rachel, who's the main character on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, finally gets like a specific diagnosis. Recently. So the setup of the show, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, is that you have this, you know, incredibly intelligent, like whip smart, emotional, impulsive, funny, just amazingly interesting young woman named Rachel, who leaves her practice in New York. She's a Harvard and Yale educated lawyer. She, you know, is discontent with her life, and she travels from New York to West Covina, California, to chase essentially her camp boyfriend, which is, you know, in her mind, the last time she was happy was when she was with this boyfriend from camp, Josh Chan. And so the show is built around sort of the life she attempts to construct as she chases this guy, Josh Chan. And it's the show really kind of wrestles with and foregrounds this term crazy, right? Like they recognize how problematic that term is and how ableist that term is, and they tackle it head on. And so one of the things that's been really interesting about the show is the way in which it deals with mental illness and the way that mental illness is stigmatized, the way that mental illness diagnoses are gendered, et cetera. And so just recently, and if we want to throw up a spoiler alert, Rachel gets a diagnosis. It turns out she's been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. And so, you know, I read this really great article on Elle.com, and we'll throw up the link for people to check it out. But there's some really interesting feminist implications to this diagnosis. Borderline personality disorder is something that is overwhelmingly diagnosed in women as opposed to men. And one of the reasons for that is because the presentation of it. So sexual impulsivity, inability to govern emotions and things like that are things that are typically associated with the feminine and with feminine bodies. And so it's really interesting take on her diagnosis, to have her diagnosed with this, right? And to have her wrestle with it and the way that it is stigmatized. Like, this is made explicit in the show, the fact that many psychiatrists don't want to treat people with borderline personality disorder, that it becomes something that you are rather than something that you have. And so the ways in which, you know, men and women and people across the gender spectrum have to wrestle with mental illness and how others see them depending upon their diagnosis, I just thought was really, you know, kind of interesting and new and groundbreaking. And I'm really interested to see where it goes. So, yeah. So super excited to see what's going on with Crazy Art Girlfriend. It's a show that has, you know, to date, you know, repaid my trust in it. You know, I think it could have gone off the rails so quickly, but so far has really repaid our trust.
Yeah, I was always super impressed by how the songs on that show were simultaneously like really funny and also had so much kind of psychological and emotional truth to them, so that even while the main character was, she was always relatably fucked up, right? I mean, maybe that's like a loaded, I shouldn't maybe say that, but I mean, like, I'm looking at her and I'm like, oh, I totally get all these things that she's feeling. So I think that the songwriting on that show is just incredible, and it's such a human, like a really humanizing show, right? That character is really complex and three-dimensional, and you root for her, and you, in spite of all the kind of, you know, not so great things she sometimes does in her pursuit of Josh and all of that. So
yeah, you know, it's a show that doesn't ask you to make excuses for Rachel or Rebecca in any way, but you nevertheless kind of, you know, see her as a fully human character. And so I absolutely love that. And I love that they're just walking headlong into what it actually means for someone to be not generically, you know, crazy in quotation marks, but to have, like, you know, actual you know, things going on with them that we can identify and pinpoint. So yeah.
So when, like, the title of the show being Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, like, from the very get-go, has the show gestured towards crazy being something that's that can be diagnosed? Or was, like, the crazy sort of being thrown around as, like, oh, she's a, you know, she's just being a woman, she's being kind of nuts, you know?
Right, but in a critical way. Like, in the theme song that on every episode, when the voices around her say crazy ex-girlfriend, the character herself reacts with, like, that's a really loaded term or something like that. Like, that's so, yeah, the show is very critical about that, even as it's employing it for comic effect. All right, so moving on, this past weekend, Ebony, Ashley, and I all went to see the brand new Pixar film Coco. And I have to say, my God, I just enjoyed this film so much.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such an, like, it just has, and I think I used this word in the intro, but it's the word that keeps popping into my head when I think about this film. It has such a, like, an exuberance to it. And so just a quick kind of plot a non-spoilery like plot setup description for people who haven't, you know, seen the film, is it centers on a boy named Miguel who comes from a family of shoemakers, like a long line of shoemakers. Miguel in his heart has like a deep passion for music, but his family basically shuns music like very strongly because generations ago, I think Miguel's great-great-grandfather, I think, was a musician who basically, you know, walked out on his family to pursue a career of, you know, of music. And so ever since then, music has just been like not tolerated within the family. And but Miguel, like in pursuit of his dream of being a musician, through circumstances that I don't really matter and that I won't like bother to try to like explain here, he kind of ends up, it's Dia de los Muertos, and there's going to be this contest in the town square, and anyway, through bizarre circumstances, Miguel, a living boy, accidentally sort of ends up in the land of the dead, where he then ends up kind of pursuing his own great-great-grandfather for hope that he can return to the living world with the blessing to pursue life as a musician. Miguel, right, first, let's just start with Miguel, because from, like, the get-go, this kid just totally wins you over.
Yes.
Like, I mean, you know, it's an animated film, and so it has to have like a kind of, you know, it has to move at a really steady pace, and it doesn't have a whole lot of time to develop character, but it just immediately you get such a great sense of who Miguel is, because he's just this really like lively young mm-hmm. boy, you know, who's like talking to his sweet old like great grandmother, who's now like very old, and you know, he'll be like saying, you know, I used to run like this, but then I started running like this, and it was so much faster, or whatever. Just like boundless energy, right? Just boundless youthful energy that's so endearing. And Ebony, why don't you
loved this movie so much, and you know, I'm not gonna lie. I'm gonna keep it 100 for our three listeners.
Mm-hmm.
Although I was kind of vaguely interested in seeing the movie, I thought, you know, whatever, I'll see it when it's available on Netflix. Like, I had no real desire to see it in theaters, despite, like, mm-hmm. the rave reviews that were coming out, right? So I was 47% salty going in on a Sunday sure. afternoon, because I was like, this is prime nap time. I can be napping right now. By the end, I was a disciple in the Church of Coco. I cried hard 2 times in this movie, which was a bit embarrassing because I'm an old black woman in the theater by myself in a house surrounded by little kids, and I'm openly mm-hmm. weeping. And so I had to like bust a smooth move when the credits rolled up so that no one was like, okay, let's call security on this crazy woman. But I found the connection with the characters was so real and so honest and so moving. You know, I just was completely immersed in that world, but also I was enraptured by how beautiful it was. Mm-hmm. I was just captivated. The colors and the lights and the textures. Mm-hmm. And when you, like, there are moments of close up on Miguel's skin, and just like you see his little freckles and, mm-hmm. you know, the dimple on the left side of his face. He had dimple on one side, not on the other side, you know. I fell in love with the family. And I loved the multi-generational Rivera family, right? And the way in which it's just understood that everybody is loved and cared for, mm-hmm. and a vital part of, you know, of the family, and you keep family together. And so, you know, there's a way in which we don't see elders that often in movies and have their, you know, we don't pay attention to their stories. And so to have the film open with Miguel talking to his great grandmother, and he's like, she doesn't, you know, talk back much. She doesn't, you know, I don't know how much she understands.
Like, she calls him by somebody else's name even. So it's kind of confronting, you know, maybe Alzheimer's without using that word or, you know, it's just kind of, and I think that's something about this film as a whole is that you almost never see in like American kind of mainstream films is not just a look at aging, but this kind of acceptance of death as a part of life, right? Like we, I think as Americans in American culture are so terrified of death that we kind of, we shove it under the carpet into the dark, you know, right. In the corner. We don't like to bring it out into the open. We don't like to talk about it. But this film, by giving us a vision of like the land of the dead that is so lively and colorful and elaborate. I mean, it was like I was looking at that, and you know, there's that great shot when Miguel kind of first arrives and he's just taken in. He's like awestruck by it. And it's so detailed and it just stretches on forever. I was thinking, oh my God, you know, like this is a place I want to like explore in a video game. It's got,
yes.
Like, it's like a functional place. You see these train cars and all these things, you know, that the functioning of the society, right? It has bureaucracy. It has like all these things that we expect a kind of not a functioning society to kind of have, right?
Yeah,
it has them.
The kind of the mirror of the living world, right? So yeah, like the bureaucracy, but you know, the different touchstones and signifiers of Mexican identity that are there and that aren't explained, you know, for a non-Mexican audience. So there are things that, you know, I knew because I'm lucky to live in Southern California. So there are certain, you know, like icons that I recognize the call outs to. And there are certain like, you know, aesthetics that I recognize, but there are many more things that I didn't, but that are really, you know, like Mexican audiences are responding to so much. So this movie is like, you know, number one movie in Mexico, highest grossing movie ever. And the response from Mexican and Mexican American audiences has been just overwhelming. And you see why. It's such an affirming, and familiarizing and loving tribute to this identity and to this culture that I felt honored to have that peek inside.
Yeah, I totally agree with both of you. It was so visually stunning. And then there was this one scene, I remember one of the skeletons was bending over and you could actually see each individual vertebrae move. And, you know, it was just incredible. But I also thought it was really interesting the way that the movie chose to pepper Spanish throughout, especially.
Yes.
So
yes.
I read that they are showing it in Spanish in particular theaters, which is awesome. But even in the English version, Spanish comes in and out and it's just interwoven. And I think that that's really important and also really interesting the way that there are particular whole segments and songs that are entirely in Spanish. And so if you are an English speaking person, you're not privy to what that is. And I think that that's super important, like an understanding of like you're just not going to fully know like that's not meant for you.
And exactly. I mean, as a viewer, I was trying to think, OK, when is the last time I can recall that like a film that really centered, you know, like Latinx or characters kind of was on like a kind of mainstream like American was on screens, just cinemas throughout America. It wasn't in any way some kind of like stereotypical story about, you know, a crime story, a story about gangs or something like that. And I mean, I'm like, what? Like, you know, Mi Familia or something? Like, I don't know. It's been like, and so for like, obviously this representation matters so much for the people of that heritage, and we'll talk just a minute about that. But also, I mean, yeah, I think it's so like I was just thrilled and took so much joy in the experience that of just the humanity of these people who so rarely are humanized on screen and so rarely have their stories told, not as like niche kind of you know, stories just only for people of that culture, but stories that, you know, I mean, this is a film that children and, you know, people, of course, of any background can go to and feel and go along on that journey and mm-hmm. feel that, right? But to speak just briefly about the importance for, you know, of that representation to the director of Pixar, the director of Coco, tweeted an email that he received from a viewer in response to the film. And I'm just going to read part of the email. It's from someone who first goes on about how, you know, she says that, you know, that my father and mother are both Mexican immigrants, and the parents don't speak English, so like when they would watch Pixar films, they'd have to kind of pause them every 5 minutes, and the kids would explain to the parents what was happening. And then so the writer goes on to say, but now there's Coco. Not only did you make a movie for mi gente, you've also made it viewable in theaters in Spanish. Let me explain why this means so much to me. Last night, for the first time in my life, I took my mom to the movies. We went to the movies like real Americans do. My mother had tears in her eyes. She hadn't been to a movie theater in over 30 years. She's always felt a bit out of place in the States, but last night she forgot she was not from here. She felt at home. And of course, the movie made us cry, too. I want to say from the bottom of my heart and from all Mexican Americans, thank you. Thank you for including us. Thank you for making my mommy feel like she belongs. And I mean, obviously, that's an experience that I think is being echoed by many Mexican Americans, you know, people writing about how much the representation in this film matters to them specifically. And so
yeah,
and
the effort that the producers and the crew like made to get it right, you know. So this was a years long process, and the director talks about, you know, how many, you know, not just like, you know, fact finding and research trips to Mexico that they took, but the mm-hmm. effort they made to make sure that the crew and the cast and people behind the scenes and, you know, the voice actors were actually, you know, Latinx people. And they had screenings, they had question and answer sessions. Like, they really made an effort, the kind of efforts that's necessary to make sure that they were being honest and approaching this culture with integrity and with honesty. And that comes across in every frame, every second, of the film.
Absolutely. Ashley, did you have something else you wanted to say before we wrap up?
Yeah, no, actually, I mean, like, this is a very, very unimportant comment, but I did want to note that the dog Dante, I know you both think I'm monsters. No, he was an utter nuisance. it is not convincing me to like dogs any more than I already don't.
Ashley. Yeah, the feminist frequency radio listeners must know that Ashley...
Not a dog
fan. Not like
not
dogs.
The biggest, no.
So
I think actually I fear this is gonna count against you in the voting for
I'm almost certain.
I think you're gonna be voted off Feminist Frequency Island.
I'm almost certain.
The fact that Ashley can only stand dogs that can fit like in a pocket.
Dogs that are cat size.
That's it. It's messed up and wrong.
Big recommendation for Coco, I think, from all of us here. Go check it out.
Go check it out. Don't go by yourself like I did and sit weirdly in a corner crying. Like, find a friend with a child that you can bring as cover.
Yeah.
But even if you do go alone, I mean, I, like, 30-year-old woman, whatever, the moment it started, I just, like, Benjamin buttoned. I was like, I'm all in. This is amazing. The music, it was beautiful.
Did y'all find that in a theater full of children, which I assume y'all's were as well, parents were constantly having to get up and take their kids to the bathroom. I don't know why it made me laugh so hard, but every 2 seconds it was a different kid having to get up and go to the bathroom. And so I was like, yeah, don't miss this at all.
Moving on from that. So in other movie news, this past week, the trailer for Avengers Infinity War dropped. It hit the earth like a meteor. This thing has like 81 million views on YouTube or something. I don't know. People are woo. So, you know, let me just quickly say, like, here's my relationship with a trailer like that. Because I sort of enjoy Marvel movies, kind of. Like, I enjoyed Thor Ragnarok, which we talked about recently. But I'm not, like, a gung-ho fan. I'm not like, oh, my God, counting the days until Avengers Infinity War released. So You know, but this trailer begins. I'm watching it on YouTube, and I'm like, eh, you know, who cares? Who cares? Whatever. And then, like, you know, pretty early on, 20, 30 seconds in, there's just, all it takes is, like, there's a shot of Mark Ruffalo, who to me is, like, one of our greatest living actors, yes. Right? And it's just, like, it's a really short shot, and it's just him, like, smiling, but kind of smiling in like a sad way or something. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, fine, I'm gonna see this movie. And, like,
take my $15.
Yeah, I really think that it's brilliant casting of Mark Ruffalo as the Hulk, because Mark Ruffalo as an actor, it's almost like he can't help but project a kind of sensitivity, a kind of intelligence, a kind of, you know, which you want that, like, human contrast almost in David Banner or whatever with Bruce Banner. With,
yeah, David Banner is the rapper, but okay.
Yeah, with the Hulk, you know, the kind of embodiment of rage and everything. But yeah, so, you know, we like to talk about, like, images of masculinity and everything. And obviously, none of us have seen Infinity War yet, but it seems to be like another. It's going to have a fair amount of punching in it. I think we can go. Think we can say that pretty safely. And it's almost like when I see those shots of, like, Ruffalo and everything, and even, like, Scarlett Johansson kind of looking like she's been through some shit. It's like, you know what I would love is, like, a 2-hour drama about these characters, like, off, you know, off duty, and, like, just dealing with, like, the emotional and, like, psychological effects of what they've been through. Like, just make it just a pure
Carol's
human story.
Carol's looking for, like, a Marvel My Dinner with Andre type situation.
I know it's never going to happen, but I would be so there for that. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I think it's a time right now in American culture. Look at all the reckoning around masculinity that's happening around the allegations, the systematic, the just proliferation of sexual assault, you know, in Hollywood, but also in just every industry, you know, kind of coming more to light and consequences happening for that, but not happening at all for, like, our president, who we all know is a serial sexual abuser, but is unaffected. And, you know, So Ashley has written some great pieces for our site, you know, over the past year about these kind of, like, intersections of kind of cultural notions of masculinity and just the values in our larger, you know, in our larger culture. And, yeah, I don't know, Ashley, like, given everything that's been happening lately, you know, with, of course, the sexual assault scandal after scandal and everything, and the conversations happening around masculinity, like, what are your thoughts right now about what's happening and where we are?
Yeah, I mean, so Marvel, admittedly, Marvel is so not my jam. I watched the trailer and I was like, who are these people? Until I saw Ruffalo and I was like, I recognize him. Perfect.
Yeah. Oh my God.
I mean, it's just, for me too, like, when I, like, watch something like that, and then even with what's going on with these individual men being called out, I don't know, I am, you know, thrilled, keep it coming, that's great, but I don't know how much a more systematic critique of, you know, like, our culture and, like, how America and Americanness is founded on this idea of really strong masculinity and, you know, and also a heterosexual masculinity. Like, I cannot watch stuff like this without being like, oh, of course, this is, like, that heterosexual masculine man. And that's, like, it's so intimately wrapped up with that other sort of, you know, weaker, effeminate, et cetera, that other, you know? And so, like, I always see those things wrapped up together. And even, like, the pieces I wrote for the site, it's like, anytime you are talking about, like, this masculine dude, you're in the back of your mind, you're contrasting that with what it means to be a woman and, like, what it means to be appropriately female.
Yeah. I mean, I remember, I think I remember that the part of the climax of Captain America, the Winter Soldier, you know, had Captain America and the Winter Soldier, like, basically punching punching each other in the face, like, repeatedly, mm-hmm. as a way, as a pathway almost towards their reconciliation as yeah. friends. Mm-hmm. And so, like, rather than, like, a heart-to-heart conversation and discussion about, like, you know, Bucky, how are you? Like, what's going on, man? What have you been through? I'm so sorry. I'm here for you or whatever. It's, you know, violence is portrayed as, like, a means of resolution of like emotional
yeah and like a viable method of communication between men, right? Like, essentially it's these men are effectively brothers, and it's one step up from stop hitting yourself, you know, as if, you know, there's and there is, you know, we could talk about like the language of violence and what it's meant to communicate. Mm-hmm. And who's allowed to speak that language, and, you know, of whom that language is required, you know. But you're absolutely right that there's going to be no rapprochement between, you know, Captain America and the Winter Soldier, his old friend Bucky, until there's a kind of physical, you know, exchange between them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Carol.
And go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say what you're saying too, like this idea that violence becomes an expression of almost like love. I mean, that idea
right.
prevails in society, and how problematic is that? I mean, it's horrifying, but I think it like feeds back to this idea that, you know, violence to protect things that you love, violence as an expression of your emotions for particular things, like it's so problematic.
Yeah, because Captain America even is like presented as, I think, you know, among the whole Marvel roster, right, he's sort of presented as potentially the most, like, virtuous, almost. Like, maybe the
yeah,
most...
like the heart.
Superman, the most Superman-like of the Marvel characters, right? Because
right.
we all know, like, Tony Stark's got, you know, he's like, a quote-unquote good guy, but he can be an asshole sometimes, and, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. Yeah, Captain America is, like, the moral heart of that team, and even for him, you know... violence is core. It's absolutely core to what defines him as like a hero.
It's very interesting that you say that, Carol, because yeah, he absolutely is like the moral center, kind of the standard, right? You know, the setting point for
yeah,
the
maybe,
morality
maybe
and
like
the purity
yeah.
of the team. And it's very interesting that he's actually not of this time, right? Like, he comes from an earlier time. And what time does he come from? Like, he was kind of, you know, forged in, you know, World War II, but this earlier, you know, ostensibly maybe more pure, for some people anyway, time in America. So it's very interesting that this site of like the morality and heart of the team, like the core Americanness, you know,
right,
is
exactly.
cited in this earlier moment, and this person who's, you know, who embodies that earlier moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, if there, you know, some people will say like, oh, Superman's kind of boring or whatever. And it's I mean, I don't really agree with that, but I get why people say it. It is kind of because he has that like wholesome, you know, whatever, like a quote unquote wholesome, like American quality to him. And Captain America is kind of, you know, in many ways the equivalent of that on the Marvel side. And yet, yeah. So I think maybe it says something then about how our history, I mean, America, like, we as Americans, certainly, you know, growing up, like, I was taught to, and I just internalized this idea of, like, American violence and American military power as, like, inherently good. Like, we are the good guys. If we're doing something in some foreign country, it's good. We're, like, fighting the bad guys. Like, we're the more, you know, the cops of the planet Earth or whatever, but actually, of course, we should all be deeply critical of like American military violence and like imperialism all over the globe. But and I think there's ways in which the kind of the incorporation of violence into characters who kind of in some way embody or represent American values, like Captain America, works to kind of encourage us to view American power as like inherently almost like righteous or good, you know, or moral.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, make no mistake, I will go in with a critical eye, but I will be completely subsumed within about 30 seconds. Like, I absolutely love the Marvel movies. I'm a sucker for them. Like, I'm already popping popcorn to watch the trailer another 60 times, you know? So I buy into the cultural myths that the movie offers wholesale, and I'll come out and, you know, I'll reopen my critical glasses afterwards. But while I'm in it, I absolutely buy into it because it is astonishingly effective while you're watching this sort of thing. And yet, absolutely is part and parcel of the stories we tell ourselves about American righteousness and other, you know, milieu, right? But yeah, so I love the trailer. I was confused because it seemed as if there were people there were 47 people in that trailer. I was like, I have no idea who some of you are, and I'm honestly not going to get to know who some of you are, and I refuse to care. But yeah, I'm into it. I love a good buddy movie, and I love a buddy movie where some, you know, there's rampant civic destruction, you know, where I take a time to wonder, like, who's paying for all of these buildings that are getting knocked down, you know, all of these windows that are getting busted. I love this kind of thing, and yeah, I'm into it. I can't wait.
Yeah, my favorite aspect of Thor Ragnarok was the buddy dynamic between Ruffalo and Hemsworth, right? When they're on that planet and they're kind of like negotiating their relationship, and Banner is sort of like, you're just using me to get to the Hulk, man. You don't care about me. Like, there's, you know, like that, because there's real heart and emotion in that. And I sort of, it frustrates me when that all gets lost ultimately in like another 20 minute punch fest, because I feel like, you know, I do kind of like these characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think the fact that we get, for whatever amount of time they're going to bless us, a little bit more of Black Panther. Come on, I'm going to see this movie 49 times just for Black Panther alone. So I'm in. Marvel, take my money. Take more of my money.
All right, y'all, it's time now for the segment everyone loves with the name Anita hates. It's What's Your Deal? Ebony, what's your deal this week?
My deal this week is a web series called Brown Girls, which was created and written by a woman named Fatima Ashgar. And this came out in February, so it's been, you know, out for several months now. But I loved the show so much, and I want to try and boost it in any way I can so that more people check it out. We'll include the link in our roundup. But essentially, and I'm reading directly from the show description right now, Brown Girls is an intimate story of the lives of two young women of color. Layla is a South Asian American writer just now owning her queerness. Patricia is a sex-positive Black American musician who is struggling to commit to anything, job, art, and relationships. While the two women come from completely different backgrounds, their friendship is ultimately what they lean on to get through the messiness of their mid-20s. I found this show such a lovely world to sink into, at the same time that I laughed at, you know, the ridiculousness of these young women, because I'm considerably older than I am. It was laughing at the familiarity of what it was like to be in your early 20s and just kind of figuring out who you are. But the thing that really just made me so happy was the vibrant warmth of this colorful world. The show takes place in Chicago. I'm sure there are some, you know, white folks in the background somewhere, but for the most part, it's all people of color. And it just felt, you know, like the kind of loving embrace of the textures and the sounds and the feeling of the urban environment in which these young women live. The lighting was superb. It was just this really golden light that bathed these lovely brown women. And I just, you know, I looked at it and it just made me want to feel you know, 25 again, which is something I would never, ever want to do, not even if you paid me millions of dollars. But just the kind of like promise and hope of you know, being with your friends and going out and exploring life and new sensations and meeting new people. But just like it was lovely. It was funny. It was fresh. It was honest. And it was just, like I said, it was so beautifully brown. I loved it. And I also, you know, importantly, I really loved how there's no, Layla, as the description said, is a young queer woman, and there's no bi erasure in this movie, which is something that's in this web series, rather, which is something that, you know, we in the queer community really have to reckon with. I love that there's this, you know, this embrace of all these facets of queer identity. Mm-hmm. So big shout out to Brown Girls and Fatima Asghar and her amazing crew of folks who put that show out there. I believe there's six 15-minute episodes, so you can watch it in a couple of hours. And again, we'll post the link, but I encourage everyone to watch it. It's amazing.
Sounds fantastic. Ashley, what's your deal this week?
Yeah. So I am all about Maria Bamford lately.
Like,
I cannot
love
get enough.
Maria Bamford. She's amazing.
I adore her. Yeah. And so the second season of Lady Dynamite is on Netflix, which I have been savoring slowly. I think it came out in November, and I finally watched the last episode like the other night.
Do you use it like a reward? Like, if you clean your house, you get to watch an episode?
Oh, 100%. It's my end of day sort of like present to myself. I'm just like, another day. Check. Time to watch Lady Dynamite.
Yeah.
So Lady Dynamite, I mean, well, Maria Bamford to start. If you're not familiar with her, I highly recommend Googling her. She's amazing. And I think this ties back to our earlier conversation about Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, because Maria talks extensively in her stand-up comedy and also in this show about her own experiences of mental illness and managing it and learning how to do that well into your adulthood. And what her work, I think, really does for me, and I've heard in folks I've talked to and things I've read for many other folks, it really works to destigmatize mental illness as this sort of individualized thing that you have to struggle with alone and overcome on your own. And so the show really tackles that in sort of the zany world that she creates. It toggles between the present day, the past, the future, and it's kind of fictional, but it definitely incorporates parts of her actual experiences and existence. And then what's also, I think, really wonderful about the show is that it not only talks about mental illness as though it's just an everyday dealing, which it is for so, so many people, but it talks about it in the context of family, which I also think we don't see enough of. Like, it's not an individualized thing. It's something that an entire family has to, you know, experience and work through. And the way that it's just, it's not this isolated thing. And so I highly recommend seeing that. And also the show is... it's created by Pam Brady and Mitch Hurwitz. And Mitch Hurwitz is, of course, from Arrested Development. And so it has that sort of same sense of humor in it. And if you were a fan of Arrested Development, this might be more palatable for you as well. I highly recommend that show. It also has like a pretty awesome cast, like Bridget Everett, Anna Gasteyer. This season, David Spade shows up, which I found really bizarre.
That is so bizarre. But so there's another Netflix show called Love, which I happen to be a big fan of. A lot of people, it's like a love or hate it thing. I love Love, but a lot of people don't. But on the second season of that, David Spade showed up too. And it's sort of like a comedic dramatic role that he does on Love. And he's actually like really good, and I was like, what the fuck?
I know.
Fucking Joe Dirt is like doing some kind of
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because the entire episode of Lady Dynamite is about him mocking himself for having ever made Joe Dirt. So it's running theme. Yeah. Yeah, it really worked
David
for me,
Spade.
I gotta say.
Yeah, cool.
Also, isn't it like the I think the guy who plays Maria Bamford's boyfriend is this Icelandic actor.
Yeah.
Ólafur Darri, right? Who was in Trapped. So in case you were wondering if I was going to find a way to bring up Scandinavian crime drama in this episode of the podcast.
No, I was just you don't need to worry. It to you.
I will always make I will always make those connections for you.
Yeah, and her mom and dad, her mom is played by Mary Kay Place. And for me, that is familiarly related to The Big Chill, which I did love back in the day.
Wow,
As a tiny, tiny child.
Could you imagine six-month-old me like, oh my God, this soundtrack is amazing.
Just dancing around the house to The Temptations.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it.
And then Ed Begley Jr. is her dad. And I am also, weirdly enough, rewatching Six Feet Under. And so he has a prominent role in season one. So a lot of stars. She's great. Google her. Find her stand-up. She's touring now. She's not backing the show, but I back her. So check her out.
Great. Yes. My deal this week, it's going to be pretty short because it's a movie that I haven't even seen yet. So I can't really speak
to it. That's a bold choice, Carolyn.
But it's a movie that I'm fascinated in and that I want to see. So when I went to see Coco this weekend, I saw that another film was playing at the same theater, another animated film called The Breadwinner, which I had not heard of at all before. But The Breadwinner is it takes place in Kabul in, like, I think 2001, like under Taliban rule. But it centers on this family, and it's particularly this young girl who whose father is, like, taken away by the Taliban, I think. And then what this girl has to do, or decides that she has to do, is start kind of dressing like a boy in order to go out into the... Because as a girl, she cannot really be productive. She can't do work in society that will bring in any money for her family. So she has to take on the, you know, the appearance or, like, the sort of cultural role of a boy to do any work to support her family, which is now struggling because the father's been taken away. And... I'm just so intrigued by this film, and I really want to see it because it seems like it could obviously it centers on a Muslim family, right? They and this the girl is the hero basically, or the protagonist of the film, which seems really humanizing, and so I feel like it has it operating in a place where it can be deeply, deeply critical, of course, of the Taliban and of the enforced, like, gender norms in that culture, while also, you know, humanizing those people, right? Because, again, like, I mean, it's not, as we've kind of talked about on, like, an episode of The Freak Show and everything, it's so common for, in Western media, for any portrayal of Muslims to be very stereotypical, very dehumanizing, to perpetuate all kinds of, like, harmful stereotypes. And so this film, it's an animated film. The animation looks so beautiful. It looks like it weaves together fantasy. Like, the girl is a storyteller, and it looks like it weaves together, like, her fantasies and the reality of life there in Kabul in these beautiful ways. So I'm just intrigued and excited that this film exists, and I'm hoping to go see it real soon.
Speaking of Coco again, real quick, y'all saw it,
yes.
Did you see the trailer? Did you see the trailer, or did they show trailers for the new Gnomes movie that's coming
yes.
out?
Yes. I was totally just going to bring this up.
First of all, I have two questions. Mm-hmm. What? That's the question.
Yeah.
And then my second question is, Johnny Depp, really?
Yes.
Like,
what?
We gonna keep giving that fool work?
I did not see this trailer.
Listen, it is not new news that dude has been trash. Why are we keep letting him collect a check? Mm-hmm. I know he's broke, but there's a lot of broke people in the world who could use the money. Somebody, please, please, please lose Johnny Depp's number. He does not need to be in any movies.
Makes me think, like, okay, so when did this business about Johnny Depp come out about him being abusive and violent?
To Amber Heard?
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, that, like, news came out a couple of years ago.
Exactly.
But he's done stuff before then, you know, like, he had kind of a shady reputation. It just...
Yeah, but like, I wonder if like that information came out now, especially in the climate that we have right now, like, would the treatment be different, or does he just get a pass for some reason? Like, I don't get
Mel it. Gibson got a pass. So clearly it's not out of the realm of possibility. They're just handing those passes out, apparently.
Yeah. Wait, but I also wanted to mention, were you two treated to a 20-minute snippet of Olaf's Frozen Adventure?
Olaf's Frozen Adventure.
Girl.
Apparently, what a delight.
I read today that Pixar may be pulling those shorts in the wake of the criticism. Because, you know, people are taking their young kids to go see Coco, and they're like, listen, my kid has a smooth 50 minutes of attention span. Yeah. So if you use up 25 minutes on this bootleg, you know, Olaf short, we're not going to make it through Coco. Also, that short is not that great. So, I mean, it would be one thing if it was a little like mini Finding Nemo or something, but it's not.
I know. But the moment that little snowman rolls out on the screen, I just can't suspect. I'm just like, I'm delighted.
Yes.
I know. I'm so sort of weird, there. And I'm really disappointed with myself. But the moment
disappointed
he started
in you too,
singing,
Ashley.
Giant grin on my face. The person I was with is like, what is wrong with you? Like, I don't know.
I have seen the movie Frozen. I remember nothing about it except my question about why who's the princess with the ice powers. Like, I just wanted her to turn full evil. I was really I wanted to see her just like wreck the world with that ice, but whatever.
Some women just want to watch the world freeze.
That would be me.
All right, everyone, that's going to do it for our show this week. You can catch us back here with a new episode every single Wednesday. Once again, a big thanks to our Drip backers. Drip is Kickstarter's brand new subscription-based crowdfunding platform. We're listener-supported, and every dollar you contribute goes directly to producing this podcast. By pitching in there, you're joining the Feminist Frequency community, and we've got some really great rewards for you. So head on over to d.rip/femfreak and join us. Wherever you're listening, whether it's on Apple, Podcast, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever, please leave us a little review. It helps get the word out about the show. And, you know, you can also help get the word out about the show by telling your friends. This Thursday, we'll be releasing a brand new episode of The Freak Show. So, looking ahead to the impending release of The Last Jedi, our new episode asks, is the Force feminist? We examine the original trilogy, Rogue One, The Force Awakens, and we completely ignore the prequel trilogy, as is good and just. Check out all of our work and our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com. You can find us each on Twitter. I am at Carolyn Michelle. Ashley, where can people find you?
I think I've tweeted 7 times. I think it's at Ash Femfreak.
No, it's not. In fact, I think it's at Fellows Ash. At Fellows Ash. Does that sound right? Maybe.
Tweet me.
All right. Fantastic. Ebony, where can people find you?
You can find me at Shirley Chisholm or at Ebony Astor.
All right. And our fearless leader, who shall return next week, is, of course, Anita, at Anita Sarkeesian. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music. That's it, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.